I was invited to Reigate, when I was living away from Reigate, to speak at Glasgow. And when I came into the meeting, there was a youngster in the front row who had been about 11 or 12, and I had never seen such a bright-eyed kid. He was full of intelligence, and as I say, bright-eyed and has a bushy tail as well. Well, I came across him again because I used to teach him, and he eventually went on to Oxford University, where he got first, and he was president of the Oxford Union. He came just after William Hague and just before Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. He then went on to Harvard in the United States, and became author, a blogger, and a political commentator. I saw him on TV the other day. There was another 12-year-old that we're thinking about today. Jesus in the temple in Jerusalem. Bright-eyed, intelligent, focused. And there he is with all these teachers of the law. So we're told in verse 46, after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers. He's there in the staff room, if you like. Let's take a closer look at Jesus in that little group. They're in the temple, first of all. It was a magnificent edifice being built by, or started to be built by, Herod the Great, and in Jesus' boyhood it would have still been under construction. It was regarded by the Jewish faith people as the centre of the world, and they thought of concentric circles running away from it. So you had at the very heart, the Holy of Holies, which was God's presence on earth. And then the rest of the temple, the Holy Temple, and then the Holy City, Jerusalem, round it, and then the Holy Land, round the Holy City, and finally the world in which the Holy Land was set. So Jesus treats it as his Father's house, because it's where God was believed to be present on earth. And the time, it was Passover time, probably April, and the city would have been packed with pilgrims who'd come up for this festival. It was the festival that commemorated the delivery of the children of Israel from Egypt and the Exodus and eventual arrival in the Promised Land. And it lasted a week, but some people used to leave early after a couple of days and go back home because of work. The weather? I wonder what the weather was like on this occasion. Maybe it was shirt-sleeve water, but not uncomfortably hot. Everything in Jerusalem Passover time would have been centered on the temple. All the priestly rituals, the slaughtering of lambs for the Passover meal, and so on. And so here is the extended family of Jesus come up, or rather down, from Nazareth. And after either 2 days or 7 or 8 days, they return to Galilee and are going to go up north via the Jordan Valley. At the end of the first day of their journey, great crew of people for protection, they find that Jesus is missing. So his parents have to go back up the Jericho Road to Jerusalem, and there they find him with the teachers. And Mary, understandably, complains. So she asks him at verse 48, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." And Jesus gives a reply. Luke stresses that Jesus was a good boy. So we're told in verse 40, the child grew and became strong and was filled with wisdom and the grace of God upon him. And in verse 42, those two verses sandwiching this story, Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. But nevertheless, I find myself asking, was there ever a time when Jesus was naughty? Did he go through terrible twos? Was he naughty as a 7-year-old? I wonder. Interesting to know. Let's zoom in a little bit closer on that group with Jesus and the teachers of the law at verse 46. And this bright-eyed 12-year-old sitting there with the grown-ups and the teachers. And what's he doing? Well, Luke tells us he's doing four things. He's listening. Good habit. He's asking questions. He's curious. I don't think the questions were things like, where do babies come from? He's a bit older for that anyway. But he might well be asking, tell me a bit more about the meaning of the Passover. He's already probably been at a Passover meal where questions would have been asked about the meaning, but he wants to know more. You know that Rudyard Kipling wrote a little poem called The Elephant's Child, and in it there are these lines. I keep six honest serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when and how and where and who. And his daughter Elsie claimed that this poem referred to her as a little girl because she was always asking questions and was known in the family as Elsie Y. Then we're told by Luke that Jesus was showing amazing understanding and then that he was answering the teacher's questions. Incidentally, there's no hint in Luke's account of Jesus being thought of as precocious, although we may well have come across a few precocious 12-year-olds. It's a fascinating scene. For one reason, it contains Jesus' first recorded words. Because, of course, all the stories we've had so far have been about him as a baby. But his first recorded words to his mum are questions. And he goes on after that, asking questions. And he was asking questions of the teachers. If you go through the four Gospels, I'm told that there are more than 300 questions from Jesus. I actually made my own list of Jesus' questions and got up to 135. But then, of course, some of the questions come in more than one Gospel, so you get doubles. It looks as though Jesus loved questions. I came across on the internet a site called 15 Reasons to Ask Questions. First reason, to acquire knowledge. And that, of course, is what Jesus as a 12-year-old was doing. He was asking questions to acquire knowledge. He wanted to learn more. Second reason, to eliminate confusion. I wonder whether a few more questions about, dare I say it, Brexit had been asked. There might have been a little less confusion. Here's the third one, and I find this fascinating. To cause somebody else to feel special or important. If you ask them a question, you're taking an interest in them. Well, it's interesting to look at those questions of Jesus that we find in the Gospels. So he does have questions to do with information. So, for example, the story of Lazarus. You know the story of Lazarus, how Jesus arrives in Bethany a bit too late after Lazarus has been, he's been informed that Lazarus is ill and Lazarus has died. And Jesus asks, where have you laid him? He doesn't know where the body is. And he's going to raise it from the dead. That was information he needed. And sometimes he asks a question in response to a question. So, for example, here's one. As Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him and fell on his knees before him. Good teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? It's a gift of a question. Someone comes up to you and says, what must I do to inherit eternal life? You'll have lots to say. What does Jesus do? Why do you call me good? Question in response to a question. Here's another one. He seems to have used questions sometimes to stir people up. So here we are in a storm on Lake Galilee, and the disciples are in the boat, and they're worried they're going to sink and drown, so they ask him to do something about it, which he does. And then at the end of the story, in Luke's version, he says to them, "Where is your faith?" Now, anyone who's a disciple of Jesus who gets that question is going to be a bit disturbed. Where is my faith? Have you heard him ask you that? Then, what about making people feel special? Well, there's a lovely story about two blind men who come up and ask to be healed of their blindness. And Jesus stops in this story and says, "What do you want me to do for you?" Wouldn't you love to hear Jesus say that question to you? What do you want me to do for you? I am this morning. Well, here's another one. Jesus is going to tell a story. And it's a story of a man who has two sons. And it's not the familiar story, it's another one about a man with two sons. And he starts off the story by saying, "What do you think?" He quite often says that. "What do you think?" He wants your opinion. He's interested. He wants you to feel special. What you have to say matters to him. And then sometimes it's challenging, his question. There's an occasion after the two feedings, the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000, when the disciples get into a bit of confusion over bread, because they've forgotten to bring any bread with them and they're going to get a bit hungry. This is how Mark tells the story. Aware of their discussion about bread, Jesus asks them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the five loaves of the 5,000, how many baskets of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the 7 loaves of the 4,000, how many basketfuls of people or pieces did you pick up?" They answered 7. He said to them, "Do you still not understand?" Wow. I don't think I would like to be on the end of that string of questions. Very disturbing, very challenging. Here's another occasion when he's challenging with a question. We're back at that incident in Bethany and the resurrection of Lazarus. And you can remember that the two sisters, Mary and Martha, come to Jesus. And Martha comes to him and says, "If you'd been here, none of this would have happened." And he says to her, wait for this, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die." What a fantastic thing to say. What an amazing statement. What a tremendous promise. And then what does he say? He says to Martha, "Do you believe this?" There's a question for us. I often think when I'm saying the creed in some of our services, the Lord might be looking at me and saying, "Do you believe this? Do you?" I like to think of Jesus coming to us with questions. I've got a lot of questions for him, as I'm sure you have as well. Because anyone who is an apprentice, to use Richard's word, apprentice or disciple, will want to ask the teacher questions. But I would like to suggest that it's good to use our imagination and to place ourselves in the gospel situation, in those situations where Jesus is asking questions, and hear them, but hear them addressed to us. Let's try it. Let's take the case of a blind beggar near Jericho. I've told this story so many times to youngsters, and I love to close their eyes and just to do some imagining. So there's this man can't see. And he's sitting on the ground, leaning against a palm tree. Jericho was called the City of Palms. It's not a coconut palm, it's a date palm. And maybe there are a few chickens around in the dust, and some goats. And there's a smell. He smells. And it's smelly because it's so hot and dry. And he hears the crowd coming along, and he calls out to Jesus, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus says to him this question: "What do you want me to do for you?" What a beautiful, beautiful question. And he says, "Rabbi, teacher, I want to see you." It's almost such an obvious question, isn't it? As a blind man, Jesus is a healer. Why does he ask what he wants to do? He loves. And he gets Bartimaeus, that's the man's name, to voice his need, his desire, his request. Now, of course, in the Bible, physical blindness, sightlessness, is sort of symbolic of spiritual blindness, the inability to see spiritual truth. Just imagine that you're blind leaning against the tree. And it's not that you're blind physically, it's that you just don't understand what the whole Jesus thing is all about, the whole Christian thing. And you would love to know, you would love to have it clearer in your head. And Jesus comes up to him. And he says, "What do you want me to do? What will you say to him?" There was another occasion when two blind men came to him, and they made the same sort of request. They wanted to see as well. And Jesus said to them, "What they wanted with you." Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" Good question. Do you believe that Jesus can open your eyes, your spiritual eyes, so that you can see the truth? Here's another occasion. The disciples in their boat in the storm on the lake. And they're worried. They think they're going to die. And we're told in Mark's version, Jesus was in the stern sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke up and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" That's some prayer. "Don't you care if we drown?" He said to his disciples after he calmed the storm, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" I just wonder whether there's someone here this morning who's afraid of something. A storm of some kind in your life. And Jesus is coming to you. He's woken up, as it were, and he's coming to you and he's saying, "What do you want me to do?" And you say, "Please calm the storm." But he does, and he will. Some questions, like those that he asked the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" are unforgettable and can have unforgettable consequences. There is a man called John Scully, who was the CEO of the Pepsi Cola Company. And he used to meet over a period of about 5 months with a chap called Steve Jobs, who was the co-founder of the Apple Computer Company. And Jobs wanted him to join the company, and he was trying to convince him to take on a job at Apple as a sort of co-leader. And Scott said to him, "I thought about it, I'm not coming." This was in 1983, in March. And then we told him the story. He paused and thought for a while, and then said to him, "Do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life? Or do you want to come with me and change the world?" What a question. And the answer was, "I want to change the world and enjoy it." is teaching the disciples on a level place, according to Luke's Gospel. And then he says to them this, and it's to the disciples. He says to them, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say?" And it makes me a bit horrified. Am I taking the privileges of discipleship for just taking them and saying, great, but not fulfilling the responsibilities? And the responsibility is to do what Jesus says. I can hear him. These challenging questions of Jesus, they're much more challenging than the ones you get in interviews. You know, what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? You ask that. Have you come far? There's a well-known question. Actually, it's not a bad question. Have you come far as a disciple? Or are you stuck where you always were? But what Jesus is asking is, have you examined yourself honestly? I tell you one horrific question. It's what I call the Gethsemane question. Jesus in Gethsemane praying on the night of his arrest, and the disciples have fallen asleep, if you will remember. He says to them, "Why are you sleeping? Get up and pray." I can hear him, and I hear him so often asking that question, "Why are you sleeping?" Is Jesus teaching his disciples on a hillside overlooking Lake Galilee? It's beautiful there. And he's saying this to them. And he's saying it to us. Do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you'll wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They don't sow or reap or store away in barns, and if your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They don't labor or spin, but I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was blessed by one of these. If that's how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? It's divine logic. It's beautiful. Worry this morning? Relax in your Father's care. Let's go back to Jerusalem, to that 12-year-old with the bright eyes, asking the questions. And I can imagine those men, some of them probably quite old, not as old as me, but quite old, round him, scratching their beards. I've never thought of that before. And he goes on continually asking questions. Why? Why all these questions from Jesus right through his life until the very end of his life and beyond, right into the resurrection? Well, they say that growth follows the knife. And what Jesus is doing is cutting with his words to the very hearts of those who are listening. He's cutting right through. And what's he doing that for? To stimulate growth. And that's what he wants for us, isn't it? That's why he comes to us with the questions. He wants us to grow into mature disciples. So listen, please listen to what he's saying, as I will try to as well, because I want to grow into a mature disciple before it's too late.